The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm James Heal and I'm joined today by The Spectator's political editor Katie Balls and the former MP and broadcaster Giles Brandreth. Now, defectors have been in the news a lot recently, and we thought we'd get Giles on to talk a bit about what it was like working in the Whip's office at the time in the 90s. But first of all, Katie, recently we've had two in 2 weeks. We had Dan Poulter, then we had Natty Elphick, both going from the Conservatives to Labour. There's lots of talk in Parliament right now, a potential third defector in many weeks. Talk us through what's happening and the mood in both parties right now.
Well, as you've just explained, there's been defections recently. I think now, since there's been two in a row, there's obviously heightened paranoia in the Tory ranks, effectively, that they could be having a drip of MPs moving from the Tory party to Labour. It's funny because I think about, 6 weeks, 2 months ago, we were all talking about defectors to the Reform Party and the Tory to Reform defections after Lee Anderson defected. And Natalie Elphick was certainly someone who the Tory Whip's office thought might defect to Reform. They never considered that she might defect to Keir Starmer's party. So I think that speaks a little to the fact those local election results, I don't think, were as decisive for Reform as perhaps they would have wanted them to be. So, and if you are an MP who wants to send a signal, perhaps line up, and this is not all of them, I'm sure, some lucrative opportunities after all, broaden your horizons. Labour seems the better bet. They're going to win this big majority. It means that you now have every week, as happened this week, I understand, the Whip's going through all the names, try and work out in advance that there are many defectors. But as, one said to me on Tuesday night, they were saying, well, have you heard anything? Do you know who might be defecting? And I was like, look, I'm okay at my job, but I'm not sure I'm Whip's
office
level.
So you're the best source of political intelligence.
But effectively, they said, well, our problem is they could have gone through every single name the week before and they never would have found Natalie Elphick's. And therefore, it's a funny game. And I think as an MP, and Giles will know more than I do on this, I think to be a defector is quite lonely, once you're a defector, because you don't really know if the other side's going to fully accept you. Lots of those who defect are never completely trusted by many colleagues in their new party, and yet you become a figure of hate and an easy target from those you've left. So I think what's notable with the most recent defections is, unlike Christian Wakeford, who defected from the Tories to Labour early on, these two, Dan Poulter and Natalie Elphick, are not sticking around after the next election, which I think is a conscious choice from Labour too. But it does also point to the fact this is, at the moment, I think more about signalling, sending a message to the Tories than probably long-term new Labour careers.
Giles, I've just been finishing your recently updated excellent diaries, and you talk about October 1995, the Conservative Party conference, and Alan Haworth defects just to upstage the conference at the time. And you write in your diaries that he is a traitor and a shit. Talk us through what it was like in the Whip's office at that time.
Well, the reason I think Bikeback decided to reissue my diaries, the new unexpurgated edition with a new introduction from me, is because there are so many echoes today in the 2020s of what was going on in the late 1990s. And I was in the Whip's office where we had a list called the U List. And these were the unstable people, like Alan Haworth, and there were others who came. And I wouldn't be surprised if at the moment, because history does seem to be repeating itself, the Conservative Party found there were one, possibly even two more defectors. And the unstable list was almost an amusing moment in the week, where at our regular Wednesday meeting, we would go through the lame and the halt, those who couldn't be there because they were sick. And then we get to the U List. And these were the people who, for a variety of reasons, we thought might be going AWOL. Sometimes it was because, well, mostly it was because they were unhappy, either the direction of policy or the direction of their own careers. And towards the end of a parliament, those who haven't been preferred or have had their moment in the sun and are now in the shade, see there is no prospect because they can see the parliament is going to end. They think that possibly their party is not going to be re-elected to government. So they can really do what they like. And nobody can hold out blandishments that can keep them, on side. So it does become more difficult. But essentially, and that's why I think the book is interesting, and thank you for reading and then rereading it, it's the first ever account of the workings of the Whip's office. And there's a misunderstanding, I think, about the Whip's office. People think they just have to be these sinister figures who bully people into coming in line. In fact, they're a mixture of human resources and the people who need to keep people in line. You've got to actually understand where your people are. And clearly the problem with Natalie Elphick is she may have been a bit of a loner to begin with, but she ought to have had 14 whips. They've all got people in their charge. And you really do need to be understanding everything about your charges, what their hopes are, what their dreams are, what their policy concerns are, also what their private lives are, what midlife crisis they may be going through. I mean, Natalie Elphick obviously has had domestic problems because of her husband and his, I think, imprisonment. But from her point of view, from Natalie Elphick's point of view, and Dan Poulter and any others that may be thinking about it, when you actually betray your friends and your colleagues, and they are friends and colleagues, by changing sides, particularly when your party, the party wearing whose rosette you were elected, nobody on your side will like you. They really won't. And you'll be going to the other side, and they won't trust you or like you either. And I think it's been quite amusing for the Conservatives to watch the way Natalie Elphick has been received. Keir Starmer embraced her without gloved hands. He actually, you know, took her into his arms and said, come on over, in order to indicate to the wider world there's a home for you disenchanted Conservatives here with Labour. Then later they discovered, oh my gosh, she really is rather a right-wing person who said some terribly negative things about the Labour Party. And it may well open up schisms within Labour, this defection. But it's the job of the Whip's Office to anticipate these things and to keep every MP close to heart and to make them feel loved and understood and to preempt these defections. But the fact that they do happen, they happened in the 1990s, they're happening again now. All that was happening then is happening today. I'll tell you one of the people I saw this week. I saw the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, this week. And it did remind me of seeing John Major in 1997. Because John Major in 1997 was concentrating on the work in hand. He was actually beginning all that stuff on Northern Ireland that paid great dividends and that people now looking back on the end of his time in office respect him for. And you know, the things he was worried about actually all turned out rather well. But you wouldn't have known that if you read the papers at the time. The papers at the time didn't touch on any of the things that John Major and his senior ministers were doing. They touched entirely on Tory rifts, the possibility of defections, scandals, MPs being caught with their trousers down. Was New Labour real? How are we going to deal with Tony Blair? All of this. And the echoes, I mean, this week, so amusingly, Keir Starmer coming up with his 6 pledges as opposed to Tony Blair's 5. I mean, almost waving the same piece of paper in the air. So the echoes are all there. And to an old hand like me, it's both fascinating and amusing. But I do feel the frustration that must be being felt by the government, who are thinking that they actually are doing the right things now and are trying to establish some clear blue water between them and the opposition, that it isn't getting quite the traction yet that it merits.
I do wonder as well, Giles, perhaps if, much like some of the defectors in the late 90s, where you had Hugh Dyke just after the election, Peter Temple Morris before it, there was a sense perhaps that the kind of Conservative coalition that won the previous election was sort of breaking down, which is both of those were on the left of the Tory party. They were pro-Heseltine, I think, pro-Euro. Much like the kind of defectors now in 2019 to 2024, perhaps the kind of coalition that got Boris Johnson into power was a little bit too wide. You've seen Lee Anderson go to the right, Christian Wakeford go to the left. Perhaps there's a danger in kind of successful electoral coalitions sometimes can't sustain themselves. And that's where you do get defectors who don't feel at home, as well, of course, as we've discussed, self-advancements and, you know, all sort of blandishments in the future, etc., all sorts of entreaties that may come in the form of ermine or otherwise. Do you think perhaps there's a sense that, you know, party management is one thing, but also there's ideology at stake as well?
There is ideology at stake. And I think that what people, Conservatives, sometimes complain about in relation to the present government is its managerial approach, saying, you know, let's stick to the plan. And these are the specific things that we are going to deal with. You know, the lowering of inflation, the dealing with the boats and all of these important issues, without actually saying how they play into what is the broader picture. And for me, the frustration at the moment is that, quite rightly, from Keir Starmer's point of view, what he's got to do is say as little as possible, just stand still, look reasonably welcoming to disenchanted Conservatives, but not so welcoming that he really upsets his core base, the left wing of his party, and they start making trouble. He's just got to say as little as possible, which he is doing. And so you almost get the position where the two parties seem indistinguishable. And if Keir Starmer can seem to be reasonable, then people will say, well, I've had enough with one lot, let's try the other lot, without thinking it through. And the reason I imagine that the government will, if they can, go for the longer haul, the October-November election, is that that will give time for some scrutiny of Labour so that people can actually see that if you don't like what's happening under the Conservatives at the moment, by voting Labour, it's going to be the same thing, but rather worse. It's going to be the same direction of travel. But to be able to afford to do the things that Labour is talking about, it will inevitably have to move towards higher taxation. Some of that it's already announced, like the VAT on school fees. But there'll be much more of that. And I think probably what the Conservatives have to do is, when they are beginning to do it, is set out a vision for why actually a Conservative government ultimately is aiming for what traditional Conservatives want, which is in many ways now to be liberal on social issues, a little bit dry on economic issues, you know, smaller government, better government, all of those things. And some of the world events, I think, play into the present government's hands. And I think Rishi was emphasizing that on Monday with his speech reminding us what a dangerous world this is. And all Keir Starmer could do is match that. The Conservatives say we're going to spend 2.5% of our GDP on defence, then that's going to be echoed immediately by Keir Starmer. So it's going to be almost, he's going to be step in step with the Conservatives. But you are right. Elections are won with a fairly broad coalition, but not so broad that it has to cover everything. You know, the Labour people have got to get something out of what's on offer from Labour, and the Conservatives have got to get something on what's on offer from the Conservatives. And that is the challenge. Chris Patten, who's gone a little bit wild in his despair at us leaving the European Union, did get it right, I think, the other day when he talked about at the time of an election, particularly after 15 years of government, you need to be somebody who gives people the benefit of the doubt. And I remember when I was chosen as a candidate, the Labour Party was 20% ahead in the polls. And everyone told me, you will never win in the city of Chester. Never win. They're 20% ahead in the polls. When election day came, I did win. And that was because, even though there had been a long period of office for the Conservatives, John Major seemed a decent person. They thought, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. And that's what Rishi Sunak now has to do between now and the autumn, is make people think, well, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I think there are a lot of shy Conservatives out there who, if they stop and think about it, will realise that Keir Starmer's government will be what we've got now, but actually painted Labour, and with greater spending, etc.
Giles, you mentioned candidate selection there, and of course we might see the Brandreth name return to Parliament after the next election, your daughter's a candidate. Just wondered what advice you would give her about interactions with the Whip's office and how to get in their good books.
Well, I've given her a copy of my diaries, but she says, Dad, I've got a lot to read, a lot of policy stuff to read, Dad. Not necessarily wanting to know what old people like you are thinking. I said, old people like me are your core voters. Get us out. She's very lucky in the sense that her constituency has a little bit of my old constituency. It has a bit of Chester South and then Eddisbury, which was represented in my day by a wonderful man called Alistair Goodlad, who was the chief whip and a delightful person. And now, though I think he had grave reservations about my publishing my diaries and my times in the Whip's office, we are good friends. And he knows how much I admired him because he taught me the art of the politician's gobble. This is when you're asked a difficult question on the doorstep. And all you do, you don't actually give an answer. You just a little bit of gobbling goes on to give the impression that you are taking it on board and possibly agreeing, but without actually committing yourself one way or the other. One of my predecessors as the MP for Chester, he used to say, when I was chosen, he said, what sort of motor have you got? I've got a good Wolseley. I said, I'm not sure they make that make of car anymore. He said, you need a good Wolseley. He said, because then you can drive around the constituency, sitting on the bonnet of your car, get a rug over the bonnet, get the mem sahib, your good lady, to sit with you, and you can drive around the constituency, get your driver to drive just a little bit faster than walking pace. So the people can see you, you can shake a few hands, but you're going a little bit too fast for them to catch up with you and ask any damn fool questions. Now, it has rather changed since those days. But happily for my daughter, she's in this rural constituency, where, in fact, her husband was brought up, went to school, etc., so, and where she lives. And so it's a part of the world they know well. I hope she is keeping a diary. And I'm so glad that people of the younger generation, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, are actually going into politics. Because it's a world where we need people of calibre and quality to stand for Parliament. I was out canvassing for her not long ago. On a Saturday afternoon, and a fellow in pyjamas answered the door. Pyjamas, Saturday afternoon. Well, what can you do? And they weren't properly tied up either. Anyway, That's by the by. I handed him my daughter's leaflet. And I said, he said, what's this? I said, it's a leaflet for my daughter. She hopes to be your representative. Please, would you consider her leaflet and perhaps vote? Consider voting for her. She's a very good person. He said, what's she got to offer then? Rather aggressively. I said, what's she got to offer? And I thought, I was rather pleased with my reply. I said, what has she got to offer? I said instantly, she has got to offer integrity and intelligence. He looked at me with a beady eye and said, you sure she's your daughter?
Just final question, Giles. You look at the 1990s, you've written about it, you look at the current state with the Whip's office. Which would you rather be serving in as a whip in which office, in which era? The 1990s with all the Europe fights, defections, or right now with all the stuff we've had in the last few years?
I like living in the here and now. I don't think it could be more difficult than it was in the 1990s, because you will have forgotten this if you even were born then. But John Major, by the end of his term in office, had no majority at all. So we were literally bringing in the lame and the halt and the sick and the dying to vote. And every defection for us actually could cost us our majority and bring on a general election. So though it is tricky and challenging now, the global situation is different. It's more worrying. And I think, as Theresa May pointed out this week, very interestingly, she naively, I think she would say now, called an election because everyone said, well, look, we've been consistently 20% ahead in the polls week after week after week. Seize the moment, woman. She seized the moment. And when the chips were down, that 20% overnight disappeared. And suddenly on election day, it was knife edge. You know, could she survive? Would she survive? Would it be a hung parliament? So I don't, that's why I'm sure Keir Starmer isn't being complacent. But I would love to be in there now. It'd be fantastic, fascinating. Because also, it's when your back is against the wall that you come out fighting and you actually think, what do I want for this country? What have I got to deliver? And it really matters. So all the defectors, nobody likes them. They're people who are disappointed in themselves, disappointed in the world around them. Let them defect. It's the good people, the true people, who keep the faith, and if they want to make changes from within and look to the future.
Well, thank you for that. It's an ending note on a paean to party loyalty. Thank you, Giles. Thank you, Katie. And thank you very much for listening to Coffee House Shots.